the top stories, Yemen warns of further attacks on Saudi Arabia following a major drone and ballistic missile strike on the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war. China sanctions a group of British lawmakers and organizations over what it calls lies and disinformation about its treatment of minorities. Also in the headlines, German chancellor, or German lawmakers, I should say, approve a new mandate that allows the country's military to remain in Afghanistan until the end of next January. Welcome. The Yemeni army says it has launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Defense Ministry has confirmed the Yemeni attack on an oil products distribution station in Jizan. The ministry said it'll take action to protect its oil exports. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army come on the 6th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of the country. The Yemeni army, backed by Ansarullah forces, has conducted similar attacks in the past. They say they are in retaliation for Riyadh's war that has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives in Yemen. Political commentator Tim Anderson says Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen in the past 6 years.
The Saudis are clearly acting as the agent of the US here. Let's not be under any illusion that they are some independent force there. They are tiny puppet regime, basically, that has a lot of oil money. It was able to buy a lot of weapons, but they are serving the interests of Washington in its plan for a new Middle East to wipe out all of the independent political will, the political states in the region, basically. And the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a is one of the things that was very inconvenient to them. And of course, Israel is also involved in this operation along with the Emiratis. So the Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand. When talk about Yemen, let's remember it's not simply Ansarullah. Ansarullah created a very large coalition. Most of the Yemeni army defected to this coalition government, and it's had very strong popular support. So we shouldn't be under no illusions, even though the Western governments continue to maintain that a man under in-house detention in Riyadh is the president of Yemen. We should be under no illusion that there is quite a strong government with a strong public backing there. And despite the siege, they've demonstrated that they're able to resist and they're able to press their advantage.
Yemenis have staged rallies to mark the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country. Rallies were held in several major cities, including the northern city of Sa'ada. Yemenis call March the 25th a national day of resilience against the Saudi-led aggression. Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end its military campaign. Political chaos in Israel. Another general election has failed to produce a clear path to a parliamentary majority. The Israeli premier is facing an uncertain political future.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents, who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority, are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had invested heavily in this week's election. Many described his path as a dangerous gambit, I should say. with the emerging stalemate, the Israeli premier, who is being tried on corruption charges, facing an uncertain political future. Let's watch this next report.
The Israeli prime minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the attorney general who will quash the corruption charges against them. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion, the ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
On to another one of our headline stories this hour. China has imposed sanctions on more than a dozen British companies and individuals for what it calls spreading lies about the situation of its Muslim Uyghur minority. Five British lawmakers, including former Conservative Party leader Ian Duncan Smith, are among those sanctioned. All of the sanctioned parties will be barred from Chinese territory, while their property will be frozen there. Also, Chinese citizens and institutions will be banned from doing business with them. China says the measures are in response to UK sanctions over alleged human rights abuses against Uyghurs.
The UK imposed unilateral sanctions on relevant Chinese individuals and entity, citing the so-called human rights issues in Xinjiang. This move, based on nothing but lies and disinformation, flagrantly breaches international law and basic norms governing international relations, grossly interferes in China's internal affairs, and severely undermines China-UK relations.
China said it is firmly determined to safeguard its national sovereignty and security. It warned of further measures if Britain goes further down the wrong path. The U.S. and the EU, as well as Canada, have also imposed sanctions on China over alleged human rights violations against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. China has rejected the allegations, saying its camps in the region offer vocational training. Germany has paved the way for its troops to stay in Afghanistan beyond an April the 30th deadline set in a last-year deal between the U.S. and the Taliban militants. German lawmakers have approved a new mandate allowing troops to remain in Afghanistan until the end of next January. The current mandate expires at the end of this month. Currently, up to 1,300 German troops are in Afghanistan as part of a NATO missile there mission, I should say. All foreign forces, including Americans, should leave Afghanistan by May the 1st in return for security guarantees from the Taliban. But now, the new U.S. government says it is hard to meet the deadline in terms of tactical reasons. The Taliban have already warned of consequences if the deadline is missed. Now, the UN's deputy humanitarian coordinator for Ethiopia has warned of, quote-unquote, an alarming crisis in the conflict-hit Tigray region. In a virtual briefing to the UN, Wafa Saeed pointed to targeted civilian killings and hundreds of recent rape cases. Saeed said an increasing number of people are fleeing of violence, while more than 4 million people need food. UN officials said children are on the brink of starvation in Tigray. Northern Ethiopian region has witnessed fighting between Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's forces and regional leaders since November of 2020. Fighting has killed thousands of people and displaced hundreds of thousands. Earlier this month, UN leaders called for an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in Tigray. EU leaders have stopped short of introducing a ban on the export of COVID-19 vaccines produced in the 27-nation bloc. This is while new data shows just over 4% of people living in the EU have been fully vaccinated. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honour their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium. This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is people are dying due to the pace of the EU's vaccination rollout programme. There's economic disaster looming for millions of businesses in the EU as new lockdowns are announced. In some nations, jobs are being lost at a record rate. The tourism industry is on its knees. Citizens are frustrated.
Our government was telling that it would be better in May and the opening of the cafes, restaurants and so on. And nowadays, I don't dare make a plan.
For the moment, the situation is so difficult that everybody's complaining about everything. And I understand that. It's not easy.
Critics say the health, social and economic consequences of the EU's failures during this crisis are not yet fully clear. Analysts warn there are likely to be dire political consequences for the establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. President Biden has held his first press conference since he took office in January. Immediate reviews of the press conference ran mostly along party lines in a nation that remains highly polarized. Following a disputed election, our very own Ramin Mazahiri is in Chicago.
After more than 2 months of almost unprecedented delay, United States President Joe Biden faced journalists in his very first press conference. Biden often read from prepared notes and spoke for just an hour. He selected the reporters who could ask him questions and avoided the conservative media, which has regularly asked that he finally engage with journalists without scripted questions or aides to help him.
Biden doesn't have any. Why? I think the speculation is very valid that he is in cognitive decline. They're worried that he wouldn't be able to hold up over press questioning for a while. They're worried that he won't be able to hold up if he had to give a good big speech.
Biden fielded questions on changes to voting laws and the Senate filibuster tactic, avoided questions on gun control, and said he expects to run for re-election. Even though the country is in the middle of the worst socioeconomic crisis since the Great Depression, the mainstream media journalists allowed to attend awarded the largest portion of their questions to a problem outside the country's borders, the increase of refugees from Latin America. there appeared to be very little of the often extreme combativeness and skepticism towards Biden as there was towards his predecessor, Donald Trump. During the presidential campaign, both mainstream media and social media corporations were routinely accused of giving Biden preferential treatment. Corruption allegations involving his son went ignored, while many said Biden rarely faced difficult questions.
There's the right-wing press that, of course, are going to attack him. And then there's the press that support him, and they're not going to say anything critical of him. They're not going to say anything critical of certain Democrats either.
On foreign policy, neither Iran nor Russia was mentioned. Regarding Afghanistan, Biden said it would be hard to meet the May 1st deadline set for America's total withdrawal, but he also said that he did not picture troops still occupying Afghanistan in 2022. Keeping up his antagonistic stance towards China, Biden alleged that Chinese President Xi Jinping, quote, doesn't have a democratic bone in his body. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Pakistan has showed off its military might with an impressive air show and display of high-tech indigenous weapons, particularly nuclear-capable missiles. Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
A massive air show in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The armed forces flexed their muscles on the eve of Pakistan's National Day. Pakistan celebrates every year the very idea of its creation in the name of Islam over 80 years ago, when this part of the world, together with India, was under the imperial rule of the British. The significant part of the air show was the acrobatic maneuverability of these warplanes known as JF Thunder. Pakistan indigenously manufactured them in cooperation with China after the US stopped the supplies of F-16 fighter jets. Pakistan is fast reducing its reliance on the US for military hardware, with the growing role of China in the indigenous production of its high-tech weapons with focus on fighter jets.
Pakistan is today manufacturing the JS-17, which has excellent capabilities in a way is replacing the F-16. And if even the spares are denied to Pakistan, it seeks those from other countries or tries to manufacture it within Pakistan. The U.S. has many restrictions and sanctions. It's relying more and more on China and other European countries.
These are the nuclear-capable missiles which Islamabad showed off to demonstrate its military might against arch-rival India. Pakistan had four wars with India, three of which over disputed Kashmir region, divided between two nuclear-armed neighbors in South Asia.
Pakistan is a strong nuclear-armed state. Beyond an iota of doubt, the peace in the region is linked with the fair solution of Kashmir dispute. We want to move forward with the desire of peace, but let me make it clear that our desire for peace must not be mistaken our weakness. Any misadventure against Pakistan would be responded back with a full force.
Kashmir dispute between two nuclear-armed neighbors have become a nuclear flashpoint after New Delhi refused to implement UN Security Council resolutions which call for plebiscite. According to a study by American think tanks like Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Simpson Center, Islamabad is far outpacing New Delhi in the development of nuclear warheads, and Pakistan would possess more nuclear weapons than any other country except Russia and U.S. within the next 4 to 5 years. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
خلاصه هرچه نظام اسلامی گسترش پیدا کنه و جلو بره با مسائل جدید داخلی و بین المللی مواجه خواهد شد.
To put it briefly, the more the Islamic government expands and moves forward, the more new issues, domestic and international challenges and situations it will face. This will make it necessary for the intellectual camp, which feeds the system, to be expanded as well. The intellectual camp that is moving the system forward, that is feeding it and preventing it from deviation, should be strengthened. New concepts should be brought up. As I mentioned, these new concepts do not come from the outside. Rather, they come from within the Islamic concepts, from the Quran and the Sunnah. Of course, this task, finding and discussing new concepts, cannot be accomplished by just anyone. It should be pursued by those scholars and thinkers who are completely familiar with Islamic principles, who have studied and deliberated on the Holy Quran carefully, and who avoid intellectual fossilization. This is because, on the one hand, there is a danger that some incompetent, semi-literate, and deviant people might try to derive new concepts from divine ayahs, and on the other hand, there is the danger that some reactionaries for whom the issue of religion's role in the social life, in politics, and in government has not been resolved yet might want to enter the arena. This should not be allowed. Such tasks should be accomplished by intellectual and outstanding personalities. This was the first issue that I wanted to discuss. The issue has great potential for further study and research.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
ليس لي رب سوى هو الرحمن
مسئله دوم که بحث سیاسی است که مختصرا عرض می‌کنم مربوط به این مسئله هسته‌ای است.
The second issue, which is a political one and which I will discuss briefly, is about the nuclear issue. Well, a certain law was passed by the Majlis. The administration welcomed the law, and until yesterday, it did what it was supposed to do for its enforcement. Another part of the law will be enforced tomorrow, and by Allah's favor, they will do it. Of course, I heard today that there's a difference of opinion between the administration and the Majlis over what the administration has done and the Majlis's interpretation of it. They should resolve this difference of opinion.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Ministry.
Six years since Saudi Arabia dragged along a coalition of Arab states to launch an unjustified war against Yemen. None of the Saudi military goals have been met. On the contrary, the Yemeni armed forces have gained more ground influence. However, the toll from the inhumane aerial and sea blockade that have taken on the people of Yemen is devastating. Yemenis need urgent humanitarian assistance to fend off hunger, to access vital health services, to maintain their dignity and resilience, and to rebuild their communities wrecked by Mohammed bin Salman's bombs. Recognized as the world's worst humanitarian crisis for the past 4 years, the country is now plunging towards the worst famine the world has seen in decades. Today in Yemen, 20 million people, that is 2 out of every 3 Yemenis, need some form of humanitarian and protection assistance. Of these, 12 million people are in acute need. More than half of the population are facing severe levels of food insecurity. Cases of serious malnutrition among children under 5 are the greatest ever recorded. Preventable disease is pervasive, and morbidity and mortality are increasing. Someone better grab Mohammed bin Salman and ask him already, is it worth it? What is so much more important than the life of a Yemeni kid starving to death because you simply impose a blockade on an entire nation? What about the consecutive U.S. administrations and European regimes who support Mohammed bin Salman's incremental genocide against Yemen? Do they ever consider individual Yemenis, especially the country's most susceptible, who are starving, suffering from disease, and bearing the brunt of almost 6 years of unjustified and inhumane war and blockade? Every one of them already knows that the only way to end the crisis in Yemen is through a lasting and inclusive peace. That can only be achieved if and when Saudi Arabia stops dropping bombs, lifts the blockade, and climbs down from its iron throne to sit at the negotiations table with the Yemeni armed forces. Quite ludicrous, to be honest with you, that Mohammed bin Salman can sit and talk with Netanyahu, but has a hard time doing the same with a nation that he shares the same history and culture with in the Arabian Peninsula. Hands off Yemen already. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The The Saudi war in Yemen shows no real signs of abating as it enters its sixth year. Civilians from across the country continue to bear the brunt of unjustified Saudi military hostilities and unlawful aerial, land, and sea blockades that resulted in a Mohammed bin Salman-made humanitarian crisis, which spiraled to approximately 20 million people waking up hungry every day. Despite the atrocities, Saudi Arabia has been trying for a year now to exit the war, as the Yemeni armed forces' advancements led to the fall of major areas once held by the Saudi occupation and its proxies, especially in the northern part of the country. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, on the sixth year of the Saudi war on Yemen, despite all the atrocities induced by the Saudi aggression, Mohammed bin Salman has been trying for over a year now to exit the war in Yemen, but it has been unsuccessful. It seems that Yemen has become quite the quagmire for Mohammed bin Salman, but how can he actually exit a war which he has not won?
Mohammed bin Salman does not have an exit strategy because he did not have one when he first started this war on Yemen March 2015. Remember when they started this war, they said officially that it would take only 2 weeks, and then they extended it into 2 months. And today, this coming Friday, we are completing six full years. On the 21st of April 2015, they had to change they repackaged this aggression and said announced officially that the decisive storm operation ended, and they announced the beginning of restoration of hope. While everything on the ground stayed the same, the only thing that deferred was that they stopped bringing up the spokes of the aggression publicly.
Well, but as well as causing the deaths and the injuries of thousands of civilians, Mr. Mohammed, the Saudi war in Yemen has exacerbated a severe humanitarian crisis, resulting in years of aerial and land blockade with the sole purpose of starving the nation into submission. This is what they are trying to do, and they have been trying to do for the past 6 years. Yet the Saudi strategy of the severe blockade has not borne any fruit yet. How come is that possible? How did that happen? The people are starving, but yet no one is submissive to the Saudi will.
Well, first of all, and above all, we have the full faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, his support and guidance. The other thing is that they have not only exercised the bombing and blockade, but also lately, as you know, they have detained fuel ships. And what that means is when you don't have an infrastructure, and they already bombed the whole infrastructure, that means a death sentence to civilians, 30 million of them. The reason why Yemenis are not submitting to their aggression and to their blockade, brutal blockade, is that the more they tighten this blockade, the more people realize that Saudi is their enemy. So people rather go to the front line and start fighting back rather than die starving on their bed.
Mr. Mohammed, since March 2015, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have led a so-called coalition of states against the nation of Yemen, and they were fighting severely against the Yemeni armed forces and the Yemeni resistance. However, over the past year, or even more than that, we saw that the alliance have fractured. We even saw some sort of a mini war happening between the proxies of Saudi Arabia and the proxies of the United Arab Emirates in the southern part of the country. Why did these proxies start to fight, and for what interest?
Let's look at first at who these proxies are. These proxies are made of different groups. Some of them are parties that they used to be official parties, like Islah or the Brotherhood, the People General Congress, who was in power for 33 years, at least part of it, who decided to join the aggression. There is also the Southern Movement, the Southern Transitional Council, And then there is the Shabwani elite forces that they created of new. There is also Al-Qaeda in there. So all those groups, they are kind of heterogeneous. They don't have anything in common. The only reason why they are standing now together is because they decided to join the aggression against their own country and their own people. They are driven by either personal motives or monetary motives. And this is very sad because they play on the margin of things. While the aggressors, the country of aggression, represented by the USA and Israel, are taking over strategic places in Yemen, such as Socotra Island, and lately UAE moved their base from Asab in Eritrea to Miyun, right in the front, the gateway of the Red Sea.
Mr. Mohammed, according to the Yemeni data project, the Saudi coalition has conducted more than 25,000 airstrikes on Yemen since the beginning of the war. That's an average of 12 per day. The coalition has bombed hospitals, school buses, markets, mosques, farms, bridges, factories, where everywhere where civilians, even prisons. Prisons were bombed by Mohammed bin Salman as well. How come all these atrocities are met with international deaf ear, yet the retaliatory attacks of the Yemeni armed forces, but especially against the oil facilities, get farther more attention from the media and the international community, if you will, as well?
Well, Yemen, the spokesman of the Yemen armed forces yesterday stated a much larger number than that for airstrikes. He said that the total airstrikes in 6 years had crossed 266,000 airstrikes. But there are a lot of airstrikes that, whether it's 25,000 or 250,000 plus airstrikes, these are atrocities coupled with the blockade. Added to that, the detention of oil ships, and all this is faced with almost no comments from the UN and international community. It's a big shame because only when Yemen retaliates that they condemn, and you hear all the noise of those people speaking about the retaliations only. The reason I think for this is because mainly U.S., the U.S. Is a part of this aggression on Yemen. So there is a huge media blackout. They don't want the word to get out. And when it does, they usually distort the facts and tell the public their own version of the story. So the fact is the U.S. has been targeting Yemen not only ever since this aggression started, the military aggression started, but we have seen during the past two weeks.
We are running low on time, but it was evident with what happened today with us, to be honest with you. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to know that it was very hard to actually get Mr. Mohammed with us because of the blockade, because of there is no internet, because there's a lot of applications that do not work in Yemen, because that's part of the war. It's war on information and war on mass media. They are not allowing us to get the voices of the Yemenis, the real Yemenis, like Mohammed Shami there from Sana'a with us, who is commemorating the sad 6 year of the Saudi war aggression, and not only war, a total aggression, war crimes against the people of Yemen, incremental genocide against the people of Yemen, which includes also a huge censorship on media. I want to thank you very, very much, Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator, for joining us from Sana'a to talk about the atrocities committed by Mohammed bin Salman, by his coalition, and by the Western regime, also funding, aiding, and abating Mohammed bin Salman. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will continue talking about the ground victories of the Yemeni armed forces.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In retaliation for the stepped-up Saudi-led military campaign and blockade against the Yemeni nation, the Yemeni armed forces carried out on Friday a new attack with six bomber drones targeting Aramco in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The news comes as Yemeni armed forces have been making major gains in their decisive push to liberate the city of Ma'rib from the grip of Saudi occupation troops and their proxies. Ma'rib prepares for liberation in this following report.
Overcoming a rugged and Sahara-like desert climate and under the constant fire of Saudi warplanes, the Yemeni armed forces advanced in Ma'rib governorate, liberating the Nakhla Valley near the western gate of the city of Ma'rib. Battles over Yemen's oil-rich Ma'rib province, which lies only 100 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a, have raged on since 2015 when the Saudi war began on the country. The clashes with Saudi occupation soldiers and their Salafist militant proxies against Sana'a's Yemeni armed forces, as well as partisans from local tribes. Those clashes have become fiercer as the war and Saudi-imposed blockade approach 6 years' duration on March 26, and amid a new push by Sana'a to liberate the last strongholds of the Saudi occupation from Mohammed bin Salman's control. For the past few months, Yemeni forces have fought a grueling ground campaign to recapture strategic points on Ma'rib battlefields, including villages and military positions surrounding Ma'rib city. Across the western and northwestern oil-rich fronts, fierce clashes have erupted as more local tribes join battles to reclaim ancient landmarks from Saudi occupation forces. 6 years have passed since Saudi Arabia attempted to impose a six-region federation of Yemen, a move that was refused by major Yemeni political parties, which saw it as a project to break up the country. Today, not only did Saudi Arabia miss all their military goals, they are also suffering heavy blows inside their own capital, Riyadh. The increase in the retaliatory attacks of the Yemen's armed forces on Aramco refineries in the Saudi capital since the beginning of 2021 are proof of the utter Saudi failure. Last week, using six bomb drones, the Yemeni armed forces stepped up their offensive on the kingdom's energy and military installations, both in Riyadh and King Khalid's military base in Khamis Mushayt. The spokesman of the Yemeni armed forces, General Yahya Sariah, stressed that the latest 6th of Sha'ban operation came in response to the Saudi brutal aggression and unjust blockade. General Sariah also reiterated his call on all citizens and companies to stay completely away from military positions as they have become legitimate targets of Yemeni armed forces and may be struck at any moment.
Now to discuss this issue with us all the way from Sydney is Jay Therapel, member of the Yemeni Solidarity Council. Thanks a million for being with us at such an early hour of the day, Jay, to discuss mainly beginning with Operation 6th of Sha'ban, where six Yemeni bomber drones targeted Aramco inside the Saudi capital Riyadh, hitting its targets with high accuracy. That's according to the spokesperson of the Yemeni Armed Forces, General Yahya Al-Sariya. Now, look, something also happened after that where Saudi Arabia bombed Sana'a, but then within hours, the Yemeni armed forces retaliated against Riyadh International Airport. Look, I'm trying to hide my smile, but I don't want to. But could you just help me explain to the audience, why am I smiling like that, Jay?
Well, I guess the reason it makes both of us smile is because we respect those who stand up to bullies. We smile because we know that Saudi Arabia will not stop bombing and starving Yemen until they start paying a price for their aggression. And it's not just Aramco that was targeted. I mean, the King Khalid military base in Asir province, which is an occupied province of Yemen, actually, Saudi-occupied, that base was also targeted by Yemeni drones. The reason this makes me smile is because it's so obvious now that the Saudis are covering up the damage being inflicted upon their military and oil infrastructure by the Yemeni resistance. And it shows that they're deeply embarrassed, because if the Saudis do start loudly publicizing to the world that they've been, let's say, victimized by Houthi drones, And if this causes people to look into what's actually happening in Yemen, then public opinion will turn against Saudi Arabia and in favor of the Yemeni national resistance. I mean, these strikes also demonstrate that there's only one state in Yemen and that the National Salvation Government based in the capital Sana'a is the legitimate government. And that's because these are not the military capabilities of the Houthis. They are the capabilities of the Yemeni armed forces. So when you're faced with an enemy that's willing to kill millions of people by using starvation as a weapon, the only way you can make it stop is by violent retaliation of the kind that raises the cost of the occupation. The Yemeni resistance is not targeting civilians inside Saudi Arabia. They're only hitting what's necessary to force the Saudis to pay a price for the genocidal war they're waging against the people of Yemen.
Well, Yemen's Ansarullah declared that U.S. is trying to come up with some sort of a ceasefire plan, but that their plan, after six long years of Saudi aggression, does not go far enough, which actually prompted them to ramp up the pressure against the Saudi regime. They are causing so much pain for the regime, zero pain for the public. This is what we should be talking about. But at the same time, Mohammed bin Salman has delayed the inevitable. He delayed so much, more than 3 years now, delaying the exit from the war and the sitting at the negotiations table. I mean, his economy is on the line here. What is he waiting for?
Well, I mean, you know, we should really be using this opportunity, I think, to talk about the war on Yemen, to also highlight just how much this war is actually costing Saudi Arabia. I mean, you mentioned the economy, and it's for good reason, because it's been estimated that the Saudis spend about $200 million per day to wage war on Yemen,
wow,
which is about $73 billion per year, which if you carry it over for about 5 to 6 years is over $400 billion. I mean, the Biden administration has indicated that it wants to at least end U.S. support for offensive operations against Yemen. And this would still represent a scaling back of support to Saudi Arabia if it were to happen. Now, here I believe that the U.S. ruling class is truly divided when it comes to Yemen. And it's for serious reasons. On the one hand, they don't want the Yemeni resistance to win. But on the other hand, every dollar that the Saudis spend on war is one less dollar that could have been spent by the Saudis to buy U.S. Treasury bonds in order to finance the debts and the deficits that the United States has become accustomed to.
Sure.
The United States is the largest debtor in the world in absolute terms. And so the U.S. needs countries like Saudi Arabia to recycle their petrodollars into the U.S. banking system, because without these injections of cash from client regimes like Saudi Arabia, the U.S. might not be able to keep its inflation under control. The fact is that the Saudis have reduced their holdings of U.S. Treasury bills over the course of 2020. Back in January, this prompted the Arab News, which is a Saudi media outlet, to reassure the United States that the decline in Saudi holdings in U.S. government bonds was consistent with the kingdom's declining foreign exchange reserves,
mm-hmm,
and did not reflect any policy of distancing between the two countries in financial markets. In other words,
it's like,
the Saudis,
sorry, we're not paying enough money.
Yeah, the Saudis are saying, look, it's not because we don't like you, America. It's because we're running out of money. That's what the Saudis are saying.
What's
Americans.
Really interesting, though, Jay, is the Yemeni armed forces are able to move this armed confrontation from Sirwah, from Al-Mshaja and the Haylan fronts, which are around the city of Ma'rib, to the actual administrative area of the city itself in Ma'rib. And we're talking about the biggest base for U.S. occupation, for Saudi occupation, and its proxies, that the Freudian slip is actually true. But this enables the Yemeni forces to move the front line from Ma'rib as well into the actual city. But the question there is here, will they be pushed to use clashes inside of the city, or will that actually increase, maybe make it a fast pace for an imminent peace in the entire city without even one bullet being fired?
I mean, the question is what forces can be mustered against the Yemeni resistance in Ma'rib. I mean, according to the spokesman of the Yemeni National Resistance, Yahya Saray, who you mentioned, 18,000 Saudi-backed mercenaries have been killed on the Ma'rib front line alone, and that was just in 2020. And over 226,000 mercenaries and traders, according to Saray, have been either killed or wounded by the Yemeni resistance, which means that the Saudi-led coalition's paid armies of mercenaries are being depleted rapidly. So where are the next fresh batch of mercenaries going to come from. Mercenaries are expensive. They're less effective on the battlefield as well. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're fighting for money, whereas the Yemeni resistance are fighting to defend their homeland, which means that they're far more effective on the battlefield. So 2 weeks ago, we started seeing reports that Turkey is thinking about sending their Al-Qaeda mercenaries to shore up the Saudi
front. I remember even talking with that, about that with you, and I was a bit skeptical about it, but look what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it shows that they need them, really. I mean, remember, over 150,000 foreign mercenaries were mobilized from across the world against Yemen. And if after all of that, the Saudis still need to get help, that too from the Turks, to prevent Marib from being liberated by the Yemeni resistance, then it shows that the Yemeni resistance is winning.
And it puts a lot on the table as to how Mohammed bin Salman is at such a low point that he's asking Turkey, his rival, for help in Yemen. But another very interesting thing that happened in the southern part of Yemen this time was storming the Al-Ma'ashiq Palace, which is in Aden, the official headquarters of the government of the so-called outgoing president, Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, last week. It was stormed by the Southern Transitional Council, which is obviously a UAE proxy. It was a severe blow to the so-called Riyadh Agreement and to all the efforts of Saudi Arabia. So losing now both influence in the southern part of the country and northern part of the country, I mean, this has been the highlight of Mohammed bin Salman's past week now. How do you think he will get out of this sort of conundrum?
See, when you combine the defeat of the Saudi-backed mercenaries in Marib with the storming of Mashiq Palace, which is the de facto capital of the so-called Hadi government, mind you, it becomes embarrassingly obvious to every international observer that the Saudi-led coalition is an empty shell, mm-hmm. that it has no significant political allies inside Yemen. I mean, even Yemeni politicians who collaborated with the Saudis, like one of them is Abdulaziz Jabari, they're angry at the Saudis for sidelining them, which shows that the so-called Hadi government is just a euphemism for a completely foreign and alien military occupation. Unfortunately, MBS is helped in this quagmire by the United Nations because of Resolution 2216, which basically says that the Saudis are acting on behalf of the legitimate government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at reports that are coming out of Aden, there's been a mass departure of Saudi officers and Yemenis from the so-called Hadi government. They're packing up and flying to Riyadh because the people of South Yemen despise them. Back mm-hmm. in January, the United Nations accused the Hadi government, that they say is legitimate, of stealing $423 million of state funds that was supposed to be used to buy food for Yemenis. This was a major reason why Yemenis stormed that palace that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and why they were met with bullets by Saudi-backed mercenaries, because they were protesting for their rights, and that's how the Saudis treat them.
Well, it seems that after 6 years of war, Mohammed bin Salman not only missed all his military targets, but also his political targets as well. Unfortunately, I'm out of time here, but thank you very much, Jay Therapel from Sydney, member of the Yemeni Solidarity Council, for being with us to talk about how the Yemeni armed forces are gaining grounds and gaining in politics as well in Yemen on the anniversary of the 6 year of the Saudi aggression against the people of Yemen. Thank you. Please stay tuned next week for the Middle East Stream.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Mother, the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wabihi nasta'in, innahu khayru nasirin wa mu'in. The month is the month of Sha'ban, the month of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The occasions in which we do have some relevance to our imams, such as the birthday of imams or martyrdoms of imams, we should have some good benefits of these occasions in seeking a proximity to God and performing our responsibility and duties toward these imams. And the one who is aware of his own personality and his relationship to his own imam can take benefit more of these occasions. Then let us focus on ourselves, focus on a day and night that we are in, and seek God's forgiveness, mercy, and blessings through our imams, especially Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about the personality of Imam Al-Husayn is not so easy for me, because Imam is such a notion. We cannot talk about the depth of this personality, but to the extent of our own understanding, we can talk a little bit about his characteristics and novelty, and take our own benefit to the extent of our own perception of this imam. Just one point I want to focus on, and then to go next to that point and come to an end, inshallah, at the end, good conclusion I want to mention. Imam had many, many characteristics, and you all know about most of them. I don't want to talk about these things. Just one issue is very important for me in the life of Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, and that is his generosity. An imam practiced generosity in all his life. And the best and the perfect generosity Imam did was on the day of Ashura in the battle of Karbala. Then Allah is going to compensate that action Imam did. What Allah did first, after martyrdom, Imam Al-Husayn became Thar Allah, the one whose revenge or revenger is Allah Himself. Allah took the responsibility of his revenge for himself, by himself. The other way, Allah compensated that. In different occasions, he encouraged people through prophet and imams to go to visit Imam Al-Husayn's grave. In every occasion he mentioned, even in the night of Qadr, in which Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam was martyred, in that night, we do have visitation of Imam Al-Husayn. In every feast days, holy days of Islam, it is mentioned it's better to go to visit Imam Al-Husayn. If you cannot go to the near, you know, visitation, then it is enough ziyarah from distance. Stay here, stay whatever you are, you live, and just face yourself and your face toward Karbala by saying, Assalamu alaikum.